I sighed. Finally, I said, "Give it to me in 3 words or less." Garrett gave me one of his toothy grins. "Ganja for computers, little bro." Whatever it did, when I put the disc in and Spider John's black web wove across the screen to the muted tune of Havana Daydreamin', Mr. Garza's computer suddenly smiled at me and mellowed out something considerable. Anything I punched in for a password seemed perfectly groovy now. "Mickey Mouse," I typed. "Cool," it said, and showed me Chef Construction's personnel files. Eddie Moraga was listed on the payroll as a half-time carpenter. No health benefits, no special duties noted, such as abducting women from their homes or intimidating English PhDs in front of Chinese restaurants. $12,000 a year, but that wasn't including a $10,000 monthly item labeled expenses. A carpenter with an expense account. Not since Jesus, I figured. I tried to access a description for that field, hit another roadblock, typed "eat me" for a password. Even then, the computer didn't offer much of an explanation for what Chef Construction expected Eddie to spend his petty cash on, just a familiar address. H.O. Amano, Gallery, 21 La Vaita Way. The expense account had been drawn on at the end of each month for the last year, in regular cash installments, and was authorized by the man whose chair I was borrowing, Terry Garza. The date for the next withdrawal was marked 7/31. I took out the 2 cut-up photos I'd retrieved from Bo's portfolio. They were marked on the back in black pen, 7/31. I looked up at Garza's picture. "Supporting the arts?" I asked him. Garza's picture smiled back, looking a little nervous. I typed a few more insults for passwords and started skimming through the chef's financial spreadsheets. There wasn't much to look at. Very few jobs had been done this year. Very little money was coming in. In fact, Chef Construction seemed to have been surviving until last year on one bread-and-butter contract alone. Travis Center. I looked at the company profits for the last decade. From 83 to 85, there hadn't been any. Just some fairly massive debts, probably some fairly nervous corporate creditors. Then, almost overnight, the debts disappeared quietly and completely. In their place had been the Travis Center project. Chef's long and healthy profit margin for the past decade until last year suggested that Travis Center had gone way over budget and way behind schedule. Your tax dollars at work. But now Travis Center was completed, and it looked like Chef Construction was heading back into the red. I looked at their projections for next year. There was only one pending deal. The entire resources of the company were already committed to building the city's new fine arts complex. Chef Construction had done their cost estimates based on the bidding price the city had approved, figured their payroll based on that income, and had a pretty good estimated timetable for their subcontractors. They would be back in the black again easily. The only problem was that the bidding process for the Fine Arts Complex project, according to my radio chum Carl Wigglesworth, hadn't even started yet. I stared at the computer screen, wondering how Chef had monopolized a huge city works project like Travis Center, and more importantly, how they could be so damn sure they would get the next one. I was just about to ask the computer those questions when the office door swung open. "Before I call the security guard," the man in the doorway said, "maybe you'd explain why you're sitting at my desk." Terry Garza didn't look as good as his picture. His silver hair was flat on the left side, and he had red lines on his cheek, like he'd been sleeping on a corduroy-covered pillow. He was wearing the same dark blue suit pants he'd had on that afternoon, half untucked from his gray Justins. His shirt was wrinkled and his tie was hanging loose around his neck. In the picture, he also wasn't holding a tiny silver .22. I shut down Spider John and spit out the disc. Then I stood up very carefully. "Sorry," I said. "I talked to Dan earlier, said I'd be coming by tonight. I thought he'd cleared it with you. Tim, out front, didn't mention you were still here." I held up my keychain as if it were proof that I'd come in legitimately. I looked innocent, meeting Garza's stare. Garza's dark eyes narrowed. The gun lowered a few inches, then came back up again. "I don't think so," he said. "Maybe if I was wearing a tie?" A smile flickered across the left side of Garza's mouth. "Timothy is his last name. Sam Timothy. Nobody calls him Tim." "Shit. Missed the comma."
"Yeah."
Garza motioned for me to come around the desk, turned me around, then did a pretty professional job of patting me down with one hand. He took the computer disk out of my pocket. "They teach you frisking in contractor school?" I asked. He gave me another half smile. We were buddies now. Then he went around the desk to reclaim his leather chair and left me standing on the other side. His face looked calm, still half asleep, but his dark eyes were alert, maybe a little anxious. They got more anxious when they saw Bo Carnow's photos on the desk. Garza looked quickly from me to the photos, to the computer, then back at me.
"So," he said thinly, "who have we got here?"
"We've got Jackson Trace Navarre, no comma." Garza stared at me for a minute. Then he actually smiled all the way.
"No kidding."
I didn't like the way he said that. Garza must have read my expression. He just shrugged.
"You made Dan angry this morning, Mr. Navarre."
So I said to him, "I'll keep my eyes open." I closed my eyes for a while and... He snapped his fingers, then pointed at me.
"I just think that's funny."
He met my eyes and tried to look relaxed, like he was in charge. His teeth were as white as his mustache. His fingers had tightened on the gun a little too much for my taste. "Hysterical," I agreed. I looked down at the family picture on his desk. "No other place to sleep, Mr. Garza? Problems at home, maybe?" Garza's smile hardened. His face turned the rusty color of hill country granite.
"Let's talk about you," he said.
I was thinking about options for leaving Garza's office without a police escort or a bullet in my anatomy. At the moment, the alternative seemed slim. I decided for the moment to confuse him with the truth. "Dan wanted to hire me," I told him. "We talked this morning about Lillian Cambridge." Garza stroked his mustache.
"Do you always start a job by investigating your boss, Mr. Navarre?"
"Only when I have questions." Garza leaned back in his chair. He propped one foot on the edge of the desk. I couldn't help noticing the bottom of his boot. No grooves. Pointed toe. Maybe a 10.5 wide.
"Such as?" he asked.
"For starters, how you got the contract on Travis Center, and how you managed to win the fine arts complex before the bidding process even started. Last I checked, fixing city contracts was a legal no-no." Garza said nothing. His smile had frozen. "I'm also wondering who the two missing people in that picture might be, who the blonde guy is, and why it might be worth $10,000 a month to Chef Construction. I keep thinking... if I were Bo Carnow and my art wasn't selling so well and I somehow came across evidence that my studio partner's fiancée was up to some very profitable, very illegal insider deals with city contracts, well, I might just be tempted to take some photos of him and whoever his partners were. I might just blackmail the hell out of them."
Garza rested the butt of his little silver gun on the top of the desk. In the light of the computer screen, it looked blue and translucent, like a water pistol.
"Is that all, Mr. Navarre?"
"Except for one thing. What size boot do you wear, Mr. Garza?"
I smiled. Garza smiled. Keeping one eye on me, Garza slipped my disk into the computer.
11 wide, Mr. Navarre. As to the rest, assuming you have any business asking, you'd have to talk to Mr. Chef."
"Which Mr. Chef? The comatose one or the one with the Looney Tunes glass in his desk? They both seem equally well-informed about the family business."
Garza shook his head, obviously disappointed in me. He showed me the hand that wasn't holding the gun, palm out.
"You see these?"
"Fingers," I said.
"I count 5.
He smiled.
Calluses, Mr. Navarre. Something you don't see much these days. A blue-collar man who's made a decent living. That's a dying breed, a dinosaur.
He tapped the family photo with the side of his gun.
Worked construction since I was 15. Don't have much formal education. But I managed to support my family pretty well. I like my employers for giving me that, and I don't have much patience for privileged young Anglo shits who break into my office at 3 in the morning and try to tear it all up.
He was still smiling, his knuckles white on the gun. Legally, we both knew. He could shoot me right now for trespassing, and the biggest complication he would face would be how to dry clean the rug. Then Spider John wove its web across the computer screen one more time to the tune of Havana Daydreamin'.
Now, let's see what you've got here, Garza said, before I erase it and decide whether or not I need to erase you.
That's when I saw the car. When the headlights got near enough to shine through the window behind Garza's desk, Garza glanced around briefly and scowled, probably wondering who the new early morning visitor could be. But he was more worried about me. He turned back to the computer screen. I couldn't see anything but headlights getting big very quickly.
Let's see what happens when he turns toward the gate, I thought.
Stupid Navarre. The car didn't turn toward the gate. I stood there frozen and watched it come straight through the fence, past my friend the cow, through the petunias, and down my throat. I think I rolled toward the doorway before the window exploded. I don't remember. When I opened my eyes a few hundred years later, I was wedged between the wall and Garza's overturned desk, about 4 inches shy of having been pressed into a human tortilla. The back of my head felt like it had rubbed off against the carpet. Somewhere close by, Terry Garza was groaning. His 11-wide boot was in my face. From floor level, all I could see of the car that had nearly killed us was the ruined front end, radiator steam hissing out in several places. Blue metal and tangled chrome teeth that looked like they were trying to eat Garza's desk. I could smell gasoline. Finally, I looked above me, hazily, and saw 3 small holes. It took me a while to realize that 2 of them were the security guard's nostrils. The 3rd was the barrel of his gun.
Jesus Christ!
Timothy S. was saying. He was pointing the gun at me, but looking into the car.
Jesus fucking H. Christ!
I tried to sit up to see what he was seeing. It wasn't one of my better ideas.
Don't even do shit, goddammit,
Timothy S. said. The quivery sound in his voice told me he was very close to breaking, even closer to blowing my face off. I sat back and jarred Garza's boot. Garza groaned. Timothy S.'s nostrils kept dilating. His face had gone totally yellow now, even his eyes.
Jesus H. Christ, he said again.
Then he threw up. The driver is dead? I asked. The guard looked at me and tried to laugh. It came out as a yelp.
Yeah, yeah. You might could say that, shithead.
Very slowly, I put up my hands.
Look, I said, I need to get up. You smell the gasoline, right?
Timothy S. just stared at me, his gun leveled.
Okay, I thought. I kept my hands in plain view while I got up. Then I hobbled out from behind the desk, bent over like a question mark.
Garza kept moaning from underneath a pile of books and unpotted plants. I looked over at where Garza's office wall had been. The car was an old blue Thunderbird convertible. Or it had been before it was driven through the wall. The hood was crumpled like a contour map of the Rockies. The windshield was shattered. Somebody had tied the wheels straight and laid a slab of granite over the accelerator. The T-Bird probably would have barreled right on through the building if it hadn't lost an axle when it jumped up onto the foundation. The driver's seat was occupied. My intestines started dissolving and trickling down into my shoes. I could see the eagle killing the snake on Eddie Moraga's forearm. Eddie was wearing the same denim shirt he'd had on the night he attacked me outside Hung Fong. Except for that, he was hard to recognize. A person can be that way when his eyes have been tunneled out with a pistol at point blank. I'm not sure what happened after that. I do know that when the police arrived, the guard and I were sitting in the broken glass, staring into space, talking like old friends about the living and the dead. Garza groaned like a chorus in the corner. I didn't care about Detective Schaefer asking me questions. I didn't even care when Jay Rivas arrived, dragged me into a room, and slapped me across the side of the face. I just spat blood and teeth and kept staring into the headlights that I still saw coming at me, running over everything and everyone that mattered. Chapter 29. Chen Man Cheng once said that if your movements were refined enough, you should be able to practice Tai Chi in a closet. He never said anything about doing it in a jail cell. When I rose to meet the new day with my usual exercise routine, my head was pounding, my stomach was empty and sore, and my mouth had swollen to the size of a small cantaloupe. The stink of old urine and semen from the bunk mattress had rubbed off on my clothes. My tongue tasted like Robert Johnson's food dish. In short, I was looking and feeling my best as I started my first set.
"What the fuck is that?" my cellmate said.
One of his parents had obviously been a Weimaraner. He was incredibly thin and desperate-looking, with splotchy skin and a face that was almost all nose. He hunched over in the top bunk, staring down at me with a pained smile. He wheezed when he spoke. Maybe I could have moved my mouth enough to respond to his question, but I didn't try. It was taking all my concentration just to keep from falling over or throwing up. After the first set, he lost interest and laid back down.
"Goddamn nutcase," he wheezed.
By the time I started my low-form routine, I'd managed to work up a good sweat. I'd like to say I felt better. The truth is, my mind was just clearer and more able to appreciate how screwed up things really were. We had the talented Mr. Carr now, whose photographs, even if they were poo-pooed by the art world, were still fetching $10,000 a month from certain interested patrons. It seemed a lot to pay for an original Carr now, unless the shot was one the buyers didn't want publicized, and the payment was blackmail money to protect, say, some illegally contracted construction jobs worth millions. Then a little payoff. A little abduction, maybe a little murder, started looking cost-effective. And Bo had started this line of work last year about the same time Lillian had demanded out of their business. Back then, Bo had gotten sufficiently violent to warrant a restraining order. Now that Lillian wanted out of the business again, she had disappeared altogether. We had the dashing Mr. Chef, who seemed eager to lead his company to greatness as soon as his mother combed his hair and tied his shoes. I couldn't see a 19-year-old Dan initiating the Travis Center scheme 10 years ago. I could barely see a 29-year-old Dan carrying on the family tradition now by fixing the bidding on the new fine arts complex. Nevertheless, he'd lied to me about Bo. I'd just about gone apoplectic when I mentioned the name, and he certainly had a strong desire to claim Lillian as his territory months after Lillian started having other ideas. Either Dan Jr. or someone else in Chef Construction, his mother or maybe Garza acting on his own, had arranged Carnell's payment. Then Lillian's kidnapping, then Garza's desperate search for whatever it was they wanted so badly. And Chef Construction wasn't in this alone. There had been two people cut out of Carnell's blackmailing photo, and two copies of it in his portfolio, which meant somebody else was getting Carnell's bill too. Maybe that somebody was getting pissed at their partners in Chef Construction. Maybe that's why Eddie Moraga had come back to work last night dead. But there were too many maybes. All night long I'd been dreaming about Eddie Moraga's blue T-bird, except it was me behind the wheel, or sometimes Lillian. She would look at me and say, "I've been saving this for you, Trace." Only one answer made sense to me about why Lillian disappeared when she did, and why Garza would want to ransack her house or gallery, then my apartment. Lillian had given me something for safekeeping, something I'd inadvertently given away. I finished Tai Chi about the time the guard brought breakfast. I tried to eat powdered eggs from a plastic tray, The pain in my mouth was so bad with every bite, I might as well have tried chewing on staples. Above me, the Weimaraner seemed to be nuzzling his breakfast to death. I held up the rest of mine, and he snatched it instantly. When I heard the metal gate buzz at the end of the hallway and two pairs of shoes coming my way, I figured Rivas was coming to gloat. Maybe he'd found some sadistic friend to bring along this time. I put on my best mean and stoic look, tried not to drool out of my busted mouth, and stood to face them. It was worse than I had imagined. When the guard slid back the door, I was standing face to face with my mother. She instantly grabbed my cheeks for a kiss and sent a wave of hot lava from my gums all the way to my toenails. "Oh, Trace," she said, "I'm sorry." Through tears of pain, I managed to nod. Mother had come prepared. Her vanilla essence was so strong it even dissolved the stench of the cell. She'd pulled a colorful Guatemalan patchwork cloak around her to ward off the institutional green. She was wearing so much Mexican silver jewelry, I imagined she could have hidden several metal files in there without arousing much suspicion. Fortunately, I didn't need to find out. She stood there, sadly shaking her head. Then she said, "Let's go home." Still dazed, I shuffled out behind her into the light and bureaucracy of the Bexar County Jail Annex. 3 or 4 pounds of paperwork later, they brought us into a conference room that was empty except for a table and 4 chairs. In one of those chairs was homicide detective Gene Schaefer, looking as sleepy as he'd sounded the first time I'd talked to him on the phone 5 days ago. In the second chair was a 50-year-old incarnation of a Ken doll, dressed in a summer-weight white Armani suit. "Trace," my mother said, looking at the Armani Ken doll, "this is Byron Ashe. Mr. Ashe has agreed to represent you." It took a minute for the name to sink in. Then I raised my eyebrows. Lord Byron, formerly of the King Ranch, probably the most high-profile corporate lawyer in South Texas. It was said that when Byron Ashe sneezed, the price of oil fell and state judges caught pneumonia. My mother would have had to mortgage her house just to pay his consultation fee. I looked at her in amazement. For some reason, she didn't seem at all pleased with her accomplishment. In fact, she seemed almost sour. "I'll explain later, dear," she muttered. Ashe smiled, slicker than Texas crude. "We were just discussing this unfortunate incident with Detective Schaefer, Mr. Navarre, and although criminal law is not my specialty, it would seem to me..." He turned that smile on Schaefer, started talking, and 15 minutes later, I was a free man. I'm not sure exactly what happened. Ashe established that I was not at present charged with anything. Certainly I was not under suspicion in the Eddie Moraga homicide. The chefs had decided not to press charges against me for trespassing. Therefore, I couldn't be held. Ashe used the word liability a lot. Schaefer made a lame admonition for me to stay available for questioning. I made a lame promise to stay out of police business. Rivas never showed up. Mother took one arm, Byron Ashe took the other, and we walked outside onto the steps of the annex. The morning sky was overcast, and a hot wind pushed dried pecan leaves across the sidewalk like little canoes. The scent of advancing rain hung in the air like aluminum. I'd never smelled anything so good. I didn't think it was possible for me to have any more surprises that morning. One dead body, almost two including myself, breakfast in jail, and a high-priced lawyer shaking my hand just about filled my quota. But when I spotted Mother's Volvo where she illegally parked it on North San Marcos, most of my internal organs folded into a slipknot and pulled themselves taut. Byron Ashe strolled down to the Volvo, shook hands with a woman waiting there, said, "No problem," then strolled away. My mother sighed. I asked her to wait. For a minute, I stopped thinking about images of the dead and started wondering whether my fly was unzipped, whether I'd washed all the blood out of my hair in the cell sink. My mother pushed me forward like she used to do in junior school cotillion dances. I felt absurd and awkward, mostly stunned. Maya Lee, gave me a dazzling smile. I almost thought you'd make it a whole week without me, Tex.
Chapter 30. Maya looked great, of course. She was wearing all white silk, blazer, blouse, and pants, and her skin glowed like hot caramel. Her hair was tied back in a rich brown ponytail. As usual, she wore no makeup or jewelry, and when she smiled, you could see why she didn't need any. I opened my mouth to say something, but all that came out was mumble. I think it would have been mumble, even without the busted mouth.
"Don't try to talk, Jackson," said my mother.
Maya's eyes glittered. She touched my jaw lightly with her fingertips. There was no pain, but I flinched. Slowly her smile dissolved. She took her hand away. I wasn't used to people being glad to see me. My look was probably harsher than it should have been. I was in pain. I was angry. I resented the way it felt to see her again. I didn't like the way my eyes kept drifting down to the cut of her blouse against her collarbone. Maya's face closed up.
"After our talk, I got concerned," she said. "I had some vacation time coming. It wasn't a problem when I couldn't find you at your apartment."
She nodded at my mother. I looked at Mother, who folded her Guatemalan cloak over her arm and sighed.
"Trace, I just wish..."
Mother let that statement hang, as if I should be able to complete it myself.
"You remember Sergeant Andrews, of course."
I nodded, not really remembering which ex-boyfriend that was. Maybe Andrews was the one who had dated my mother for a few months after her divorce, before she'd exploded into full bohemian. As I recall, he'd shown up one night with roses and a couple of T-bones and found her burning patchouli incense over a spread of tarot cards. He never came by much after that.
"Sergeant Andrews was good enough to call me."
Mother made it obvious that some people had not been.
"Miss Lee insisted on helping. She suggested Mr. Ashe."
Mother was resentful. Maya had interrupted a perfectly good maternal rescue operation, and now Mother was obliged to stand apart from her, avoid eye contact, and do her best to look hurt. She crossed her arms and hugged her silver and Guatemalan prints tight. If Maya noticed, she ignored it. She met my eyes again and tried to make her tone light as she spoke.
"So," she said, "here I am."
All three of us, feeling wonderful, we rode north on McAllister toward my mother's dentist's office while the rainstorm came through. After 10 minutes, my mother, never one for prolonged silences, tried to break the ice. She put on a cassette of Buddhist chants.
"Chinese mysticism is so fascinating," she told Maya. "I've been studying it for years, off and on."
Maya had been staring out at the rolling live oak forest along the highway. She pulled her eyes away and smiled absently at my mother.
"I'll have to take your word for it," she said. "Is there a good place to get huevos rancheros on the way, Ms. McGinnis? I'm afraid I'm starving."
I could almost see my mother cringing closer to the driver's side window. We listened to the windshield wipers for the rest of the drive. I should have insisted on going home immediately, but I was tired, and it felt good just for the moment to be carried along, lying down in the back seat of my mother's car for the first time in 20 years. I let myself be carried right into Dr. Long's office. My dentist from elementary school, Dr. Long, was older and grayer now, but his hands were just as big and clumsy inside my mouth as I remembered.
"Well," he said, "anything for a friend."
When my mother smiled her warmest smile, Dr. Long smiled back and immediately cleared his afternoon appointments. Through a haze of anesthetics, we had a great one-sided discussion about the advance in porcelain grafting technology. When he poured me out of the chair and into the waiting room around 5 o'clock, he didn't even offer me a lollipop. The first word I said was,
"Van Diver."
Mother looked overjoyed, at least until I walked into her house and started rifling through her knick-knack displays for the Mexican statuette that Lillian had given me a week ago at the gallery. I finally found it on top of the piano, the two skeleton lovers in their hideously glazed orange car
parked contentedly between a book of Zen poetry and a horseshoe. I repossessed the statuette, then walked out to Mother's Volvo again. I said,
"Home."
It took my mother a few minutes to realize I meant Queen Anne Street. Then, looking pained, she asked Jess McCarr to meet us there when he had liberated my impounded VW. 15 minutes later, Mother dropped Maya and me off at number 90 and was almost convinced she could leave us there safely when Jess drove up in my car. The 45 holes in the ragtop flapped wildly.
"Trace," she said.
She started to get out of the car for the third time. I just shook my head and kissed her cheek. Jess nodded at me, gave Maya a long look, then climbed into the passenger seat.
"Trace,"
she said again.
"Mother,"
I mumbled,
"thank you. But go home now, it's okay."
"And Lillian?"
I couldn't meet her eyes. I couldn't look at Maya either, as we went up the steps. After I'd made sure that no one had been in the house, I stretched out on the futon. I stared at the water stain of Australia on the ceiling. Maya stood over me, hugging her arms.
"Byron Ash?"
I said.
Maya shrugged very slightly. "He owed me a favor. His son and I were at Berkeley together."
"I don't remember his name on that list of job possibilities you gave me."
Maya managed a smile as she sat down next to me.
"Not that big of a favor, Tex."
Eventually I slept. Me and my hollow-eyed chauffeur driving a Thunderbird blindly into some dreams about men with little silver guns, Looney Tunes glasses full of bourbon, and pictures of authentic cowboys. I'm not sure, but I imagined Maya keeping watch over me all night. I think she kissed me once, very lightly on the temple. Or maybe I just dreamed that too. At the time, I wasn't sure which thought was more disturbing. Chapter 31. When I woke up the next morning, all the police records and news clippings were stacked in neat piles around Maya's bare feet. She changed into a beige sundress and her hair was loose around her shoulders. Robert Johnson sat on her lap, sticking out his tongue at me.
"So which one is Halcombe?"
Maya said. She looked up and smiled. I tried to focus on the mugshots she was showing me.
"Halcombe?" I repeated.
I tried to lift my head. It throbbed, but the swelling around my jaw had gone down to nothing larger than a Mexican lime. My new teeth felt slick, like the side of a pool. I looked up at Maya's very awake face.
"Shit," I mumbled. "I can't believe you're here."
It almost felt good to resent something so familiar for a change. I'd forgotten the way she woke me up with her pop quizzes, always at the bedside, fully dressed, no matter how early I tried to rise, ready to pummel me with questions about cases I was working on, world politics, the PG&E bill. I stared glumly at Maya's coffee mug.
"Wait a minute," I said, catching the scent.
"You brought Pete's?"
She raised her eyebrows.
"You get none until you talk to me."
"That's inhuman. Talk," she ordered. I muttered some of her own Mandarin curses, then sat up and straightened my T-shirt.
"All right, that one's Randall Halcombe."
I pointed to the mugshot of a scraggly-looking man, shoulder-length blonde hair, darker beard, thin face, a nose that had been broken at least once. Halcombe's eyelids were heavy and his mouth upturned at the corners, as if he'd been pleasantly stoned when he was booked. He looked much too content to steal a Pontiac or to drive it past a sheriff's house with the intent to kill.
"One of the others could have been Halcombe's accomplice in the drive-by," I said. "There had to be at least two people in the car, one to drive, one to shoot."
"All those guys knew Halcombe in prison, are all still alive and free as far as I can tell, and if you don't give me that coffee now, I'll have to kill you."
"You can try."
She poured me a cup only after she'd poured a little more into Robert Johnson's saucer. "He definitely does not need caffeine," I warned her.
"You're just jealous," she said.
Maybe it was true. The trader required exactly the right mix of blend 101 and whole milk, a recipe only Maya had had the patience to master. He lapped at his café au lait and stared at me smugly.
"So," said Maya, Maybe one of these men was involved in your father's death and got past an FBI investigation.
Right. She shook her head.
Or maybe the FBI knew what they were doing, Trace. Maybe this line of suspects goes nowhere.
I drank my coffee.
On the table in front of me, the Express News headlines for the Thunderbird murder glared in lurid color. Detective Schaefer was answering questions. Terry Garza was looking battered, trying not to look terrified. Garza told the paper that, yes, the dead man, Eddie Moraga, had worked for Chef Construction, but that Moraga had been laid off several months ago.
Right.
Eddie's face had been fuzzed out of the newspaper photos, just enough to titillate the gentle reader. You could vaguely see the dark holes of his eyes. The trademark execution style of a well-known South Texas crime syndicate, one caption declared. Guy White's name was mentioned. The nature of the death would lead to speculations about mob involvement. This would be a PR nightmare for Chef Construction. There was no mention of me, which might explain why Carlin McGaffrey wasn't sitting in my lap yet. I spent a few minutes bringing my up-to-date on what I'd learned from Mr. Garza's computer. When I finished, she stared at her bare feet for a minute, flexing her toes against the stack of police reports.
Mr. Chef is involved with some bad people, she said. These fixed city contracts? I've seen two cases like it before in the Bay Area, Trace. Both times the mob was behind it. They give the construction firm an assurance that the city project will go to them with the price tag they want and with no labor problems. The mob provides the bribery and the arm twisting. In return, they cut themselves in for several million. The project always goes way over budget and behind schedule. Huge profits all around.
I stared at her.
And you know about this because...
She shrugged.
One of those cases I was defending the contractor. We won.
Terrence and Goldman, always fighting the good fight.
Trace, Maya said, if Bo Carnow messed up a profitable arrangement between Chef and the mob by trying blackmail, and if Chef's people got blamed for letting it happen or botching the payoff...
She looked down at the picture of Eddie Moraga's corpse.
I nodded, trying to believe it. I remembered Dan Chef behind his father's big desk, looking 9 years old, his hair sticking up like canary wings. I tried to imagine him playing some kind of hardball game with Guy White's organization, making millions illegally off fixed bids on city projects, then ordering his employees to kill, abduct, wreak havoc on any who might find out, all while he was drinking Chivas from a Foghorn Leghorn glass.
Then the living room wall rang. Maya frowned. I pulled down the ironing board and took the receiver.
Mr. Navarre, the man said. It took me a minute to recognize Terry Garza's voice. It sounded like someone had mixed it with a few quarts of water, like Garza had been driving around all night in the same Thunderbird as me and was getting a little shaken up by the company.
I think it's time we talked, Garza said. I looked at Maya. Her eyebrows came together. She silently mouthed,
What?
I'm listening, I said into the phone.
No, in person, Garza said. This has to be in person.
Because you want me to bring the statuette. I waited for him to confirm it. Obviously, Garza didn't feel it was necessary.
I'm a good employee, Mr. Navarre, I told you that. But I didn't sign on for this. I have a family.
Who shot Eddie Moraga? Behind Garza, I heard the drone of highway traffic, the background buzz of a payphone connection.
Let's just say two parties are interested in what you have, Mr. Navarre. When the other party breaks into your apartment in the middle of the night, you won't wake up at the next morning. Do you understand that?
I looked at Maya.
I'll be at Earl Abel's tomorrow morning at 7, Garza said. I tell you what you need to know about your girlfriend. You give me what I need to smooth things over. We might be able to get things back to normal.
If your employers don't release Lily in Cambridge, there's not going to be any normal. Garza exhaled sharply, or maybe it was a nervous laugh.
We need to have a talk, Mr. Navarre. We really do.
He hung up. I stared at Maya. She looked at me, her eyes intensely black.
Tell me, she said.
I looked down at the front page of the paper again, where Eddie's dead face was a circle of fuzz in the bottom corner. I told Maya what Garza had said. She mixed cream into her coffee by turning the cup in little horizontal circles.
Garza's desperate to set things right before he becomes the next sacrificial lamb, she said.
I nodded. Maya studied me over the top of her cup.
You still think we're not dealing with the mob?
It's convenient. Homicide will look at how Moraga was killed, then they'll bring in Vice, then the FBI task force. Pretty soon, everything is focused on Guy White, just like it was 10 years ago with my father's murder. Maya paused, choosing her words carefully.
Trace, I want you to think about this. What if this is separate from your father's death? What if you've walked into something that has nothing to do with that, or your questions about the investigation, something that isn't your fault?
I stared at her. Then I swallowed. It felt as if I were back in the dentist's chair, someone's big, awkward hands rearranging my mouth, sending muted but persistent jabs of pain down the nerves of my jaw. Do you think that would matter now? She lowered her eyes. Her voice grew hard around the edges.
I think it should. Lillian has her own life, Trace, and she can create her own problems. You're both grown-ups now. Maybe you should start thinking about it that way.
Grown-ups, I repeated. So why the hell are you following me around like my damn mother? I guess I deserved it. At least the coffee had cooled off a little before she threw it in my face. Then, since there wasn't really any place to go to get away, Maya walked out the back door and sat down on Gary Hales's patio. I took a long shower and changed before I went out to apologize. I put the ceramic road trip statuette on the table and sat across from Maya. We both stared at it. The two skeleton lovers grinned back at us from the front seat of their little orange car. A few blocks away, the ice cream truck went by playing a warped rendition of La Bamba. This is hard, I told Maya. I'm sorry. Her eyes were only a little red. I could almost convince myself it was just from the sleepless night. She forced a smile.
I liked you better with a busted mouth.
You and half of Texas, I said. I noticed Gary Hales looking out his bedroom window at us, his face so drooping and soft with amazement it seemed about to melt off. I waved. After another minute of silence, Maya picked up the statuette and turned it around. The skeletons in the convertible kept grinning, grotesque and shiny white.
If you're right, somebody wants this back very badly, Maya said, and not just for the artistic quality.
So let's assume the obvious.
Yes.
I let her do the honors. The statuette hit the pavement. I'm not sure what I was expecting to find inside when the ceramic car cracked open. At first, I didn't see anything but clay. Then I nudged it with my toe, and the back seat broke neatly open along a crack as thin as a piggy bank slot. Maya picked up the small silver disc by the edges and held it up to her eye, looking through the hole like a monocle.
"Don't suppose you have a CD-ROM drive," she said.
When I heard the slow shuffle of my landlord's feet, I looked up.
"I reckon you'll be cleaning up that mess now," Gary Hales asked mildly.
"I reckon," I said. Chapter 32 "Bats?" I said. "Bats," said my half-brother Garrett. "I'll admit," I said, "it's a word I often think of when your name comes up."
"I'm not shitting you, little bro. You have to see this. It's fucking unreal."
I covered the receiver and looked over at Maya. "How'd you like to take a little road trip?" I asked her. She just stared at me.
"What?"
"Just to Austin. My brother wants to show us the sights." Maya's arms folded.
"How many no reasons do you want? Detective Schaefer wants you in town. Your car stands out on the road like a neon advertisement. You've been shot at and almost run over."
I uncovered the receiver.
"We'd love to," I told Garrett.
"Cool," he said. "You remember what the Carmen Miranda looks like?" That would be kind of difficult to forget.
"The bridge at 8, little bro."
Instead of terminating my life, Maya compromised with me. She agreed to go to Austin. I agreed to let her rent a car for the trip. By early afternoon, we were heading north on I-35 in a brown Buick so nondescript it was almost invisible. Maya kept having to honk at people to keep them from drifting into us on the highway. By the time we passed Live Oak, I was convinced we were not being tailed. "I would have preferred a white Cadillac," I protested.
"Asshole," she said.
When we hit Selma, I discovered that the universe as I knew it had come to an end. The old Selma Police Department building had been turned into a bar and grill. For decades, the terror of all motorists wanting to drive about 55.5 miles per hour, the town had finally cashed in its speed trap reputation for tourist dollars. The sign out front promised free appetizers with any proof of moving violation. And that was only the first surprise. The I-35 corridor was almost non-stop developments now. There were outlet malls where cow pastures and ranch houses had once been. Fast food restaurants in knolls once filled with barbed wire and stands of mesquite trees. As we moved along the edge of the hill country, I found myself less and less sure where I was. Even the few remaining cattle along the side of the highway looked confused. When we stopped for a late lunch at a restaurant I remembered on the San Marcos River, we found the place had closed 4 years ago. So we settled for a loaf of bread, a jug of wine, and a billboard of Ralph the Swimming Pig in the park across from Wonder World. Paddle boats went by on the river. A few unambitious wetsuit divers braved the 10-foot-deep green waters. Ralph the Swimming Pig and Maya kept looking at me.
"You haven't told me what you're thinking," Maya said.
I chewed on my bread and cheese and watched the river. It had taken me a few minutes to realize why I felt so bad being here again. Then I'd remembered that time with Lillian, Christmas break, when we'd gotten stupid drunk and gone skinny dipping around midnight, just a few yards upriver from here with a band of coked-up bluegrass players. The water had been so cold our lips turned purple. I remembered Lillian. Then I looked at Maya, sitting there in the sunlight, her eyes almost gold. The part of my mind that was trying to put the facts together felt like it was threading a needle with a pair of cooking mitts on.
"Trace?"
"Yeah, I know. I just don't have an answer yet." She ran her finger along the edge of her wine glass.
"Do you want to hear mine?"
She waited. I kept eating flavorless bread. Maya looked back down at her wine glass and swore under her breath, something about me being a stupid white devil.
"Damn it, Trace. Do you think Lillian gave you that statuette accidentally? Do you think she didn't know what would happen when it turned up missing? How can you keep seeing her as just the victim?"
I stared out at the river. "Maybe."
"Maybe," she repeated. "What if, just maybe, Lillian disappeared on purpose? If it were me, once I realized the person I'd been trying to blackmail was really the mob, I'd admit I was in over my head, and I'd run like hell. Maybe first I'd send up the only distress signal I could think of to you. How are you going to know the truth when you see it?"
"The truth," I looked at her. "Maya, I know you're trying to help. The truth is, you're distracting the hell out of me." I think I wanted it to sound angry, but it didn't come out that way. Maya started to answer, then pressed her lips together. For a moment she looked cold in the sunshine, hugging her knees and curling up her toes under her beige sundress.
"Tell me to go home, then," she said.
I looked down. We sat silent for a while and threw bread to some sickly-looking ducks. Sometimes they ate it. Most of the time, they just stared at us and let the pieces hit them in the face. No points for intelligence. At the moment, I empathized.
"Okay, then," Maya said. "Tell me you'll come back."
The paddle boaters laughed. Ralph the Pig grinned at me. I looked at Maya's sad half-smile and listened to the devil talking on my shoulder. I was chasing ghosts through a town I barely remembered, dealing with the people I could barely see through emotional scar tissue. Maya could be right. I'd only made things different for the worse. And a beautiful woman, was offering me escape from the first 20 years of my life, it would have taken a stupid man to tell Maya Lee no. No, I said. Maya just nodded. She gave me a hand and pulled me up. We looked at each other for a minute. Then she turned and headed toward the car. I beamed a mallard with the last of the bread. He stood there for a minute with the same dazed expression I probably had. Then he honked and went skittering into the San Marcos River like he'd seen a ghost. Chapter 33. Around 8, we pulled into the Marriott parking lot off Riverside in Austin and walked down to the water. You could barely see the city because of the sunset. Town Lake was a half-mile sheet of corrugated silver. Beyond it, behind a few wooded hills, downtown blazed with a dozen mirrored office buildings I'd never seen before. About the only things that looked the same as in 1985 were the red dome of the Capitol and the white UT Tower. The cement underside of the Congress Avenue Bridge echoed with chatters from a few million bats and only slightly fewer sightseers. When I spotted Garrett, he'd just pulled his wheelchair up to a newly erected plaque that honored the Bats of Austin, and was staring with distaste at the army of camera toters. His tie-dyed shirt was stretched a little tighter these days, and he'd gone almost completely gray. But he still looked like the love child of Charles Manson and Santa Claus, minus the legs. "Man," he said by way of greeting, "this is worse than fucking Carlsbad. They've discovered this place." We shook hands. Garrett looked at Maya for a moment longer than he needed to, scratching his beard. Then he nodded. "Last time I was here," he said, "it was me, a couple of Hell's Angels, three kayakers, and a lady with a poodle. Now look at this shit." He led the way down the grassy slope, waving gnats out of his face and running over as many people's feet as he could. Maya and I followed a few yards back. "That's..." Maya started to whisper. She looked at me, then at Garrett's rainbow-clad back. "Yeah, my half-brother."
"You didn't mention..."
"That he's so much older than me." Maya glared at me.
"We got about 5 minutes," Garrett called back to us. He swung his chair around and squinted up at the top of the bridge where the stone arches made a honeycomb of little caves. "Then the little peckers start coming out thicker'n pig shit."
A line of retirees was standing in front of us, watching the bridge with binoculars. When we sat down on the grass knoll, I found myself staring at a row of old butts in pastel prints. I exchanged looks with Garrett. He grinned.
"Yeah," he said. "Kind of gives you a different perspective of the world, doesn't it?"
Maya sat down between us, her left arm pressing against mine just slightly, very warm. She smelled like amber. But of course I noticed none of that. She put her other hand on Garrett's armrest.
"So, Garrett," she said, "Trace tells me you can break into high-security networks with half your RAM tied behind your back."
Garrett laughed. He had more teeth than any human being I'd ever known, most of them yellow and crooked. Maya smiled back at him like he was Cary Grant.
"Yeah, well," he said, "my little brother tends to exaggerate."
"He also says you could be running the world if you didn't spend so much time at Jimmy Buffett concerts."
Garrett shrugged, but he had a pleased gleam in his eyes.
"A man's got to have a hobby," he said. "Just please, no jokes about wasting away in Margaritaville. That one got old faster than Ronald Reagan."
Maya laughed. Then in a very quiet, very passable voice, she started singing A Pirate Looks at 40. Garrett kept smiling, but he looked at Maya as if he were reevaluating her.
"My theme song these days," Garrett said.
"Mine too."
It was the first and only indicator I'd ever had of Maya's age. Garrett showed his teeth, all 100 of them.
"So, Trace," he said, "where'd you meet this lady again?"
With that, he took out a joint and lit up. Paranoia was not a concept that existed in Garrett's mind. I'd seen him smoking pot in shopping malls, restaurants, just about anywhere. If questioned, he would talk poker-faced about his prescription. Nobody ever wanted to argue much with a paraplegic. The line of retired sightseers froze when the smell of the mota hit them. They glanced back nervously at Garrett, then dissolved. We no longer had butts obstructing our view of the bridge. Maya and I both refused the joint politely. Then Garrett spent half an hour telling us about his last parrot head tour of the South, his asshole bosses at RNI, the impending collapse of Austin society at the hands of Silicon Valley transplants.
"Damn Californians," he concluded.
"I beg your pardon," said Maya.
Garrett grinned.
"You can come into the state, honey. It's just this ugly bastard you brought with you."
I showed Garrett a hand gesture. Maya laughed. It got dark and cool. God poured grenadine on the horizon. Finally, when he was ready to talk business, Garrett said,
"So what's all this about, little brother?"
I told him. For a minute, Garrett blew smoke. He stared at me, then at Maya's legs. His expression told me he'd just reevaluated my IQ downward a hefty percentage.
"So you and Maya are looking for Lillian," I said.
"More or less," said Maya.
Garrett shook his head.
"Unreal."
"Can you look at the disc for us?" I asked Garrett. Cameras flashed as the first few bats flitted overhead like sparrows with hangovers. Garrett glanced up at them, shook his head to indicate that the real show hadn't begun yet, then turned back to us. He pulled his tie-dyed shirt back down over his belly.
"I don't guess you want my advice," he said.
"Not really," I said.
"Sounds to me like this is your old girlfriend's gig," he said. "Turn this shit over to somebody else and walk, little brother."
Somebody on the bridge shouted. When I looked up, a woman in pink was leaning over the railing with her arms dangling into a steady stream of bats.
"They tickle," she shouted to her friends.
People laughed. More cameras went off.
"Fuckers," said Garrett. "The flashes disorient the hell out of the bats. They run into cars and shit. Don't they know that, fuckers?"
The last word he shouted into the crowd. Only a few people turned around. Nobody wanted to argue with him, maybe, but nobody wanted to pay him any attention either.
"Trace."
In the twilight, Maya's face was losing its features, so it was hard to guess her expression. But her arm still pressed against mine, warmer than ever. She waited for me to say something. When I didn't, she turned to Garrett.
"Can you look at it, Garrett?" she asked.
His scowl softened. Maybe it was Maya's hand on his armrest. Maybe it was the joint.
"Sure," he said. "Whatever. But it seems to me you got to get a life, little brother. Picking at old wounds. Fuck. If I'd spent my life with that, they'd have locked me up by now."
He met my eyes only for a second. Then he laughed and shook his head. Whatever pain was there, it had been buried a long time ago under drug abuse, wildness, testiness and arrogance, all the Navarre family values. I couldn't help it. I tried again to imagine Garrett at those dark railroad tracks 20 years ago, the confident train hitcher, the intractable hippie, running away from home for the 20th and last time, the one time he'd sprinted to the freight car and missed the rungs. I tried to see his face, pale with shock, looking desperately at the black glistening lake where his legs had been. I tried to imagine him for once without